This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with Bill Quigley on Memorial Day.
Hypocrisy? Your name is Memorial Day. Yes, we should remember the dead, but we should also remember the thousands, perhaps millions, that this country is killing in a permanent war that has been going on since I was a child some 60 years ago.
Tensions between North and South Korea have turned terrible in the wake of a sinking of a ship. Today we'll speak with Eric Sorotkin of the National Lawyers Guild and the Korean Peace Project.
When you hear the context, you won't be so quick to believe Hillary Clinton and what the United States says about these tensions.
We'll talk with ACLU attorney Jonathan Heifetz on the first military commission's trial under the Obama administration concerning Omar Khadr.
I wish I could say more of the same, possibly even worse under Obama. Now it's a 15-year-old child soldier who's turned 23 while he's been rotting in Guantanamo, and they're using a rump military commission to claim he's guilty of a war crime.
Stay with us. What will you remember on Memorial Day? U.S. law officially proclaims Memorial Day as a day of prayer for permanent peace. However, the United States is much closer to permanent war than permanent peace. Thus writes Bill Quigley, legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, in his recent article titled, No End in Sight, Number One in War. The article outlines the rising costs of war, the damage to our country, and who's reaping massive profits. At what point do we begin to transition to permanent peace? Welcome, Bill, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Bill, the U.S. Law officially proclaims Memorial Day as a day of prayer for permanent peace. There's something wrong with that when you think of the assassination that they're trying to conduct, the amount of money that they spend on war. What's your take?
My take is that the United States is really, we've really, really lost our way. I do know that Memorial Day is by congressional resolution a day to set aside for prayer for permanent peace. But it seems like with each passing year, the United States is more and more committed to permanent war than permanent peace. And, you know, there are a lot of reasons for that. Politicians are making a lot of hay off of playing to people's fears. But there's also some people who are making an awful lot of money off of this, the United States' incredible spending on the military. I don't think we can at all discount the role that they are playing in keeping the United States just constantly fearful and constantly interested in preparing for and perpetrating war at every place across the globe.
Bill, some of the figures that you cite in your article are utterly staggering. We're talking over $6 trillion, which is a million spent on war and preparation since 2001 alone.
Yes, I mean, I think general people understand that the United States spends a lot of money on the military, but because we do not have any discussion about it, I don't think that people understand how much. You know, we have all these discussions about health care and how much it costs and who's going to get what and how much, whether your doctor's going to get that. We have all this discussion about Social Security. We're having discussion about can we afford to fix the environment? Can we afford to get off? But we really rarely have any real discussion in Washington, D.C. or any place else, real discussion about the biggest part of our budget, which is preparing for and paying for the wars that we've already done and the wars that we're doing right now and the wars that we're planning on doing. We have Memorial Day, you know, every elected official in the country is going to be out on Memorial Day waving an American flag, putting a rose on somebody's headstone, that sort of thing. But how many people actually going to talk about how could we make sure that this doesn't happen anymore? There's going to be a handful of officials at the most that are going to talk about it. This is something that people are afraid to talk about. And it is an incredible cost. This year, the federal budget, which people can get, it's online, it's available to everybody, the plan for this year is $708 billion for the Department of Defense alone, another $125 billion for the Veterans Affairs, which just those two, and that doesn't count everybody, that doesn't count the State Department, all the other people have their own little private armies and private spy rings and everything else, and all the things that they don't report to us. But those two alone come to $830 billion. And it's hard for people to understand billions and that sort of stuff, but that puts the United States at roughly 40%, just that, those two things, 40% of all the money that is spent in the entire world in the coming year will be spent by the United States. And second place of China, China's spending one-tenth, they're spending about $80 billion, one-tenth of what we are spending on the military. And the so-called axis of evil, you know, Iran and Syria, places like that that, you know, supposedly are so threatening to us, they're spending, you know, less than 1% of what the United States spend. Al-Qaeda is less than 1% of 1% of what the United States spend. And when people face that, you have to really look at this idea about, well, why? Why is this so attractive? Why are people in the United States more afraid than anybody else in the whole world? I don't, you know, I think people are people. And our environment, though, with our elected officials really fanning the flames of fear, or just do it again and again because they profit off of that. But behind the scenes, that's not so well known, there are huge corporations that are making billions of dollars off of the United States going to war. We all know, everybody knows about Blackwater and others that, you know, put individuals, you know, with guns in places all over the world that are, you know, private military contractors. And we talk about Blackwater, and they're very, very controversial. But there are a couple of corporations out there that dwarf Blackwater.
You mentioned them in your article, which is called, the article is called No End in Sight.
Yes.
So mention these other corporations, Bill.
Yeah, well, the three biggest, Lockheed Martin, you know, most people don't know is a huge corporation that runs almost entirely on taxpayer money. If we cut the federal funds to these folks, the money that goes to them, they'd be out of business in no time. They have 140,000 employees. They take in $40 billion annually. They're the largest military contractor in the world. And of the $40 billion that they bring in each year, over $35 billion comes from the United States Congress. So you talk about welfare, you talk about who's on the federal tap and who's reliant on that. This is a corporation that is totally reliant on the United States Congress. And they are not acting at all as if they are a public corporation or anything like that, because their chair, guy Robert Stevens, and again, you can find this all online if you look at their 2010 proxy report, which they don't make it too easy to find, but by law they have to show you that. Buried in that thing, they explain how much money he makes. And he made $72 million over the past 3 years. And you say, well, what's so special about Lockheed Martin that the guy is going to make $70 million as a military contractor? What's going on? How do they do it? Well, they are a great example of this revolving door, that their board of directors, who for sitting on the board, a lot of people have sat on various boards, so they know that there's some work involved, certainly, but sitting on the board of Lockheed Martin, you get over $200,000 a year just to sit on the board. And on their board, they have former U.S. Air Force commanders of the Strategic Command in Europe, a deputy director of Homeland Security, former Undersecretary of Defense, all that sort of stuff. So then Lockheed Martin takes people from the military and from the Congress. They put them on their board. They give them very generous pay to help them figure out how to go back into Congress and get more. And then, and all this is all public stuff, but Lockheed Martin, since 98, just for the last 10 or 12 years, has spent over $125 million lobbying Congress. So our money goes, the Congress takes, they give it to this group to make military weapons. This group decides to hire people from the military to help run their corporation. Then they use our money that we gave them, another $100 million of that, they put that aside to go back and lobby Congress to get some more, and then it starts all over again. There's dozens of corporations like that. They're just the biggest.
Bill, it's no wonder that we're in this state of perpetual war, as it were, because the corporations are taking billions from the government. They profit from this. Why stop?
No, I mean, there is no reason to stop. If you don't spend $125 million lobbying Congress and Congress doesn't get some benefit from that. The congressmen, congresswomen, they know who the lobbyists are for Lockheed Martin. In some cases, they're people who used to be in Congress. And then their other people were in the military. So they're coming. They're spending a lot of money. They turn around. Lockheed Martin has decided strategically they have offices in every one of the 50 states. So they are lobbying and getting money from Congress. That's their biggest business. And so as a result, then the United States is spending more, 10 times more, on military than China, which is the second biggest spender in the world. So we're spending 10 times more than China on our military. And at the same time, people like Lockheed Martin, they are not only making weapons for us to use, they are making weapons and turning around selling them to South Korea, to Israel, to other places like that, the United Arab Emirates, and then the United States ends up being number one, not only in what we're paying ourselves for to make weapons, but number one in exporting weapons around the world. So this idea that Memorial Day is set aside as a prayer for permanent peace, it's like, you know, the people 150 years ago or something like that went to the local church on Sunday and then went back out on Monday and drove their slaves through the fields. I mean, the disparity between, you know, what we say we're about as a country and what I think most people in the country think we are about is one thing, and how we operate is another. And this is not, you know, just the rants of pacifists. This is, you know, some of the people who listen will recall that Dwight Eisenhower was a very successful general and, is, you know, was very committed to defense of the United States. He made it very clear that he thought, and this was his last speech as president of the United States, he thought that one of the greatest threats to the United States was what we call the military-industrial complex, where the military and the people who profit off the military get together with the Congress, and then they end up having their own agenda that is accountable to no one. So what is the accountability in 2010 on Memorial Day? Who is holding spending on this down in the Congress? Who is calling for accountability and transparency for these people? Nobody. Really, this is, we are just accepting that as a nation, that most people are just accepting that this is the, you know, this is the best we can do. And unfortunately, it, you know, the rest of the world knows this very well. And this is not legitimate defense spending. This is offense.
Yeah, you know, that's for sure, Bill. I was thinking of Eisenhower's speech, which occurred 50 years ago when they closed down my neighborhood hospital, St. Vincent's Hospital, which could have been saved for the cost of maybe two fighter planes. And instead, they dispersed all the doctors and nurses there, and I think they're going to make the hospital into a condo. Let me switch gears, if I might, Bill Quigley, legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights. One thing that's been in the headlines over the last several weeks, which is very disturbing, is the order by Obama and the administration to try to assassinate an American-born Muslim cleric who's hiding out in the Middle East. Talk about that, will you?
Yeah, I think this is a very clear example of how our leaders have lost their minds. If they think about it for 60 seconds, realize that the United States government can't just secretly decide that they are going to assassinate somebody in another country and be accountable to nobody. This is a decision that was made in secret. It's not subject to approval by the Congress. It has not been subject to approval by the judiciary, and it's illegal for several reasons. You know, the older listeners can recall in the 50s and 60s and 70s, the United States, through the CIA, was involved in assassination attempts, trying to kill Castro in Cuba, the head of the Congo, the head of the Dominican Republic, the head of South Vietnam, people that we didn't like. We went ahead and either tried, in many cases, we were successful in assassinating them. And as a result, President Ford, President Reagan, every president since then, have had an executive order that says no employee of the United States shall engage in or be involved in any way political assassination, either in this country or any other country. But yet we are now sort of bragging to the world that we can assassinate anybody, any place that we choose. So it's illegal, according to the presidency's own executive orders. It's illegal because we certainly couldn't do this in the United States. The United States doesn't have the right to just go and kill somebody in the United States without, you know, trying to arrest them, trying to give them a trial, that sort of stuff. But why we would think we had the authority to do it in other countries, and particularly, you know, we wouldn't talk about this if we were doing this in Canada or Australia or France or Italy or places like that, although, you know, the CIA has been accused of doing renditions in some of those places, but actually assassinating people here lately. So the Constitution, the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution prohibits it. The orders of the presidency, even Ronald Reagan, you know, prohibited this. And then if people say, well, this is just part of our war on terrorism, if that is allowed to go through, then there is a blank check to the President of the United States to assassinate anybody, any place, any time, for any reason, and is accountable to nobody. That doesn't just threaten us around the world.
Basically says the president can just decide without any kind of trial or anything else that this person might be guilty of something and go to any country in the world and throw a drone onto him. I mean, this is not Afghanistan. I mean, this is not the supposed claim, you know, that they make that they gave authorization to go after the people who were involved in 9/11. This is a different case. This is something that isn't around 9/11. This is another country. It's another person. It's allegedly another group. And there's no authority in law to do it. And if the president asserts it, I think, Bill, it's exactly what you're saying.
Well, the other thing, too, is one of the tests for these things is whether it's right or not, is do we think it would be right for other people to do it? I mean, other countries. Do we think it'd be okay for France to just come and execute somebody in the United States?
It's the international golden rule.
You just can't do that. And the only way we are getting away with it is because we are big and because we are powerful and because we are not accountable to anybody. And that, clearly, if we don't have any accountability, we don't have any transparency, we don't even internally have any accountability or any checks and balances, that is a recipe for a disaster of incredible proportions for this country. And the fact that it is going forward, I think, without congressional outroar, without outrage by most of the people in the United States, just is a real sad commentary for us on Memorial Day about how far we are from doing anything more than just making an awful lot more cemetery plots for an awful lot more people.
When Frederick Douglass, on July 4th, they asked him to give a talk. He'd been a freed slave, but slavery was still existing. And he gave this amazing talk that said, what of your July 4th? What of your independence when in bondage are, you know, millions of my brothers and sisters? And it's almost what you're really saying about Memorial Day, which is to say, what of your memorials for the dead when, in fact, the country that you're part of, that you're congresspeople for, that you're out there for, is killing thousands and thousands of people and will continue to kill thousands and thousands of people. So it's essentially a fraud in that sense. And I think that's what you're really bringing home to us, and I think it's an important message.
It is the message. It's a very sad message, and it's not a message that people, most people, realize that we are sending. But that's why it's so important for you know, programs like yours to be able to, you know, provoke people and make them think.
Bill Quigley, you're the legal director for the Center for Constitutional Rights, and you're also one of the greatest fanners of the flames of discontent that we know. And we thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Today we get an update on the uneasy tensions between North and South Korea. A multinational investigation concluded last week that a North Korean submarine had torpedoed the 1,200-ton warship called the Chunonan back in March, killing 45 people. North Korea denies involvement in the sinking. South Korean defense minister denies that any of its ships had crossed northern limit line. Meanwhile, the threat of sanctions against the North Korean population escalate. South Korea and the Obama administration have agreed to initiate joint anti-submarine military exercises near the North Korean border. Right now, there are almost 29,000 U.S. troops in South Korea. To talk more about this, we're joined by attorney Eric Sorotkin. He's a member of the National Lawyers Guild, and he helped found the Korean Peace Project.
Eric, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Eric, we're going to ask you about what's going on with North Korea and South Korea. And you have to assume that your listeners, like your hosts, know very little. So all we see in the paper is some torpedo went into a South Korean ship. 46 people were killed. And now there's a break in diplomatic relations. The United States is trying to persuade the UN to get sanctions. They're thinking about a war, and the stock market is dropping. What's going on? Give us a background. What's happened here?
Well, I'm glad you asked about background, because what we found, even amongst progressives, is that there is such a lack of understanding about the Korean conflict. Even when I first became involved in Korea, I knew very little about it. I knew what I'd seen on MASH reruns, and I knew about the UN and the war, and generally. Really, when you look into the history of the conflict and the idea that we are still technically at war, as an armistice doesn't end a war, it only stops the shooting. These kinds of incidences occur because you don't have a peace regimen to fall back on. What has happened in this situation is you have a very conservative South Korean government. That government now, Moonbak government, is very hawkish toward the North, and this has sort of played right into their strategy, which unfortunately has been to build up and increase the militarism in the South, restrict civil liberties, and then be able to, at that point, cut off aid and essentially try to strangle the North into some kind of change, which we found over the years has never worked. This situation, specifically in connection with the torpedoing of the boat, really raises a lot of questions. There are people who are writing about Tonkin Bay and thinking about what happened in Vietnam and other places, because the initial reports and most of the reports all around it seemed to indicate that a submarine couldn't operate where this boat did, couldn't have done that level of destruction through one torpedo, etc. There's a lot of questions about that. But really, what it comes down to is to simplify the issue. You have a choice. You have a choice to march toward war, or you have a choice to go toward peace. And this is an example of what happens, even if it was a torpedo from the North, if it wasn't. To me, the question is simply, how would we establish peace? And that would be an ending of the Korean War, which is now 60 years in June this year, since the Korean War started. And it seems to me that the U.S. has never established diplomatic relations, or the South Koreans have never established diplomatic relations with the North, even though 158 other countries have. And it seems to me that this cries out for a resolution with a peace agreement, establishing formal diplomatic relations so that these kinds of incidences can be avoided.
Eric Sorotkin from the National Lawyers Guild, he's part of the Korea Peace Project. Eric, what role has the United States been playing in this?
The United States has, at this point, is unfortunately amping up the rhetoric, and it is not helpful. It could be such an opportunity and such a coup for the Obama administration to establish a peace agreement, even an executive agreement, because frankly, I don't think a treaty would clear the Senate in this climate. But I think a peace agreement and a normalization of relationships can make a huge difference. And what we found is Secretary Clinton, particularly, or Kurt Campbell from the State Department, their comments have been very hostile and very based on retribution, when they really fail to look at the history and fail to understand that the North, whether it's nuclear weapons or whether it's this incident that has come up, the North Koreans have always said they would denuclearize in exchange for a peace agreement. I mean, there's no reason to maintain the separation. And before this situation with the South and the North, we had a lot more exchanges, and things were going in such a more positive direction earlier in this decade. That was because the South had a lot of exchanges. When I was there, a group of South Korean women golfers played a tournament in North Korea called the Pyongyang Open.
It did seem that way to me. I mean, I unfollowed closely, but I followed, obviously, the early history in the 50s and I.F. Stone's book and all that. And then I did follow in the early decade. It seemed to be opening up a lot. And so what caused it to all of a sudden the whole thing to just deteriorate like that? And now I agree with you, the rhetoric, and it's not just rhetoric when it comes from the Secretary of State, is just awful on this.
Yeah, what happened in the early part of the decade, when Clinton was going out, he was going to visit North Korea. It was going to be one of his last acts as president. And then the election debacle happened and some Middle East issues, he couldn't go. But you remember Secretary of State Albright went, and then both North and South Korean in the Sydney Olympics marched under one flag and had one into the stadium at that point. People were very encouraged. And exchanges continued to grow and continued to grow under the more liberal administrations in South Korea. But then the United States was totally the stumbling block. You had the Axis of Evil Declaration. You had the idea of, in the Nuclear Posture Review in 2002, the Bush administration came out and said North Korea is a target for nuclear preemption. And so what do? You watch an illegal invasion in Iraq. You're one of the other two countries of this axis of evil. What are you going to do? You're going to get a nuclear bomb, probably, because you know it's probably your only deterrent. And even while doing this, the North was speaking up about willing to denuclearize for a peace agreement and ending the war. And I think that's very doable. I think it's unfortunate that we stood in the way, that we see our strategic interests as being so necessary in South Korea, which, if you think there's no exit strategy from Iraq, look at Korea 60 years later. We still have 28,000.
Yeah, that's a good point. We're speaking with Eric Siratkin of the Korean Peace Project. He's a fellow member of the National Lawyers Guild with Michael and I. Eric, what is the Korean Peace Project asking people to do?
We're working with a national campaign to end the Korean War, and it's endthekoreanwar.org. You can visit there, or you can visit at nlg.org/Korea. What we're doing through a national coalition is to get people, first, to get on the website, sign a petition. Secondly, to just call the White House line and write to whitehouse.gov a note that it's time to end the Korean War, that a peace response to these kinds of acts and setting up a peace regime would totally negate the necessity or the tragedy, rather, of any of these kinds of incidences. And I think that if people began to step forward and do that, get their organizations to sign on with the national campaign, and keep an open mind, because, frankly, the demonization level of North Korea has been so strong, and I've been there several times, and it's not, of course, an ideal place, and it has problems, and there's human rights issues and other issues that after 60 years on the edge of war probably are related to that and other factors. But the issue is we need to have a formal way to deal with when journalists stumble over the line, when something happens. We need to have representatives in Pyongyang. We need to change through engagement. And so ask the Obama administration to enter a peace agreement, to set up engagement as the policy, and to formalize diplomatic relations so we're not dealing through the Swiss and other side channels to deal with something that's become such a crisis. EndTheKoreanWar.org or nlg.org/Korea. And there's a whole list. There's sample congressional letters there. There's fact sheets. And things that will shock you, we really want people to wake up to recognize that a peaceful North, South Korea, Japan, and China as a region would be huge for world peace. And we need the peace and justice community to get on board with this and really see that ending the Korean War will help build world peace in some really strong ways.
Eric Sorotkin, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Thanks, Eric. I appreciate it.
Take care. All right.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Military tribunal opened under the Obama administration. It is the case of Omar Khadr, the Canadian citizen military prosecutors say threw a grenade that killed a U.S. Special Forces medic in Afghanistan, and also that he helped build roadside bombs to use against American soldiers. We look at why the Obama administration is putting a detainee on trial who was 15 years old when he was captured. We welcome back Jonathan Heifetz, an attorney with the ACLU's National Security Project, to talk more about this story. Jonathan, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, great to be here, Michael.
Jonathan, over the years, we've talked a lot about military commissions, which are, of course, the special trials initially set up by President Bush and now continued, unfortunately, by President Obama. And let's first talk about one that's going on now. The case of Omar Khadr is currently being considered by a military commission. What is it, and who's Omar Khadr?
Well, Omar Khadr is a Canadian citizen who was arrested or seized in Afghanistan in connection with basically a firefight there. He was then taken to Bagram. He was actually very badly hurt in the fight, taken to Bagram. He was accused or believed to have injured or killed, actually, a U.S. serviceman. He was tortured, taken to Guantanamo, held in abusive conditions for many years, and he's now being tried by a military commission for violating the law of war. And his case really raises, I think, or highlights some of the most or the biggest problems with Guantanamo.
Now, he was only 15 when he was picked up, right?
That's right. He was only 15 when he was picked up.
So even apart from all the other problems, the U.S. has a special problem because he's, quote, a child soldier who shouldn't have been treated as a soldier, really.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that is a special and big problem for this case. I mean, the international law is very clear about not how you treat child soldiers. The U.S. is party to international agreements. There's customary international law prohibiting, the way that Khadr was treated and trying Khadr for war crimes. They have a big problem in the fact that he was only 15 when he was taken, abused, and halfway across the world, and has been held now for 9 years.
Was he tortured under interrogation, Jonathan?
He was. I mean, he was tortured under interrogation, including at Bagram and as well as at Guantanamo. So there was a lot of mistreatment. It was the type of mistreatment that was really endemic at the time, that was part of U.S. policy in terms of using or going outside the Geneva Conventions. And Khadr was a victim of those policies, which, raises a number of problems. I mean, above and beyond the fact that he was only 15 years old at the time, it also is incredibly problematic because one of the issues in the case is the government's effort to rely on statements that were obtained, in abusive interrogations or after abusive interrogations that are simply not reliable and should not be admissible in any kind of legal proceeding.
Of course, that's one of the reasons that there's a military commission here is because if they put him into a federal criminal court, they couldn't do very much. But let's go to that military commission business because, you and I, as we've litigated this over the years and looked at it, have not been very happy about the use of military commissions under Bush. And, Obama suspended them for 4 months and now is continuing them. And why don't you talk about what that means?
Yeah, I mean, the military commissions have, they keep on going, and they should have been ended by Obama. President Bush created them, as we know, in 2001. They were struck down by the Supreme Court in 2006 in the Hamdan case. Congress created them again. And then three people were tried under military commissions in very, very tainted proceedings, not regarded as credible. We could talk about them, if we want. But then Obama came in, and the hope was, as he'd promised during his campaign, that he was going to really close this chapter and he was going to end military commissions in the second-class system of justice. But unfortunately, Obama continued the commissions. Congress passed a new statute which made the commissions better in some respects, but it doesn't resolve their fundamental problems. And, we're still trying to use these commissions as a way of prosecuting people at Guantanamo instead of charging them in the federal courts, which are the internationally recognized system, the system that's consistent with our Constitution and our values.
Jonathan, I used to do a little military law during Vietnam, and we would quote Clemenceau's observation that military justice is to justice as military music is to music.
These aren't even that, Michael. These aren't courts martial.
Yeah,
these are even the level below a court martial.
The fundamental flaw then was that under the court martial, there's command influence, and how can you have a neutral trier? But this is even worse. You got a 15-year-old kid who's wounded, who's then tortured, and now is put on trial by a military commission. What would you as an attorney do to defend a guy like that?
Yeah, I mean, just to clarify, this is actually, you know, very different than the courts martial, which now mirror in many ways our federal court system. In some sense, are more protective. And the big problem with the commissions is that they are a second-class system. They're not military justice, and they don't meet our civilian standards either. I think that as an attorney, I mean, I think it would certainly bring the various legal challenges and assault the different flaws in the system. And you have the child soldier issue. You also have a huge issue in Qatar's case that what he's accused of doing, I mean, there's two problems. He's accused of killing a U.S. serviceman in a firefight. One, the government does not have or doesn't seem to have any credible evidence, not derived from torture or other abuse, that Qatar actually killed the servicemen. So they have a problem with the facts, but they also have a big problem with the law. Even if they had evidence that Qatar was responsible for this unfortunate death of a U.S. service member, it's not a war crime.
Now, why is that? You know, I've been reading that, and I follow the listserv with you. Why isn't he's not wearing a uniform? He's supposedly what they call an unprivileged combatant, or whatever term. And you're saying it's not a war crime to throw a grenade at an American soldier in that situation?
That's right. It's part of war, but it's not a war crime because it was thrown at a U.S. military person and a person who was engaged in hostilities. That's not a war crime because Qatar was not a privileged belligerent, someone who we would refer to as a POW or a lawful combatant. He could be prosecuted criminally under domestic law. Law of Afghanistan, even conceivably the law of the United States, for that act. But it's not a war crime. I mean, the government's theory of war is totally distorted. Basically, they're saying we're fighting a war against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. But if anybody who fights back, or everyone on the other side, is by definition a war crime, if they fight a war criminal, if they fight against us. I mean, that's a theory that has no basis in the law of war. I mean, the idea of a war crime is someone who carries out activities that are prohibited by the law of war. For example, you know, targeting civilians or doing something like that, but not simply someone who engages in what would otherwise be lawful military activity, but simply is just not a privileged combatant. That's not a war crime. And there's a real international consensus on that. And so the government, the Defense Department, is currently way out of line and out of step with those laws in trying Qatar.
So you have the 15-year-old problem. You have the problem that that the evidence is very questionable, to put it mildly. You have the problem that it's not a war crime. And there's a number of things the trial is actually ongoing in a court in Guantanamo. Is that right?
That's right. There have been some preliminary proceedings late last month and this month involving the Qatar's attempt to suppress his statements that he made in his custodial interrogations.
And has there been anything surprising going on in there? I mean, I just hear from stories that it's like a very shocking thing that's actually happening in the court.
Well, yeah, I think there are a number of things that have been happening that are just showing that these commissions have not been and cannot be fixed. I mean, first of all, the day that the proceedings start, you get a 275-page rule book, a new rule book on how the trials are supposed to go. So imagine that in the first war crimes trial, right, of a juvenile in U.S. history, right? Because the day it starts, you get the new rules are handed out, and I don't even think they had enough copies to give to every all the counsel and everyone in the courtroom. But in any event, the idea that the new rules come out the day the proceedings start, I mean, it's a kangaroo type atmosphere. We also have the fact that four reporters were banned. So we have an issue of continuing problem with secrecy, and they were banned for basically reporting what had been, as I understand it, in the public domain. But because it was referred to during the trial and it was reported, they were banned from the commission proceedings, including Carol Rosenberg, who is from the Miami Herald, who's been the most faithful and fearless Guantanamo correspondent. So you have these problems of secrecy or excessive secrecy, things that would never happen in a federal court. And you know, it's again this idea about trying to have a trial system that we make up as we go along. And it's just clearly it's not working. And it's really very disappointing that the new administration is continuing to press this case.
You know, what's really shocking about it is here you have this trial of a 15, formerly 15, now 23, with all these problems that you're raising about it, and yet you're seeing in our Congress, and of course in the administration, not only continuing it, but wanting to occasionally get legislation saying we shouldn't try anybody in federal courts, everybody should go before military commissions, they should all be tried outside the country, and that's the sort of, I can't say prevailing, but close to prevailing view of these guys. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it comes up, Michael, every time we have, anything happens. For example, when we had Abdul Muttalib, the attempted, Christmas Day airplane bomber, and we had the Times Square bomber, or attempted bomber from last month, it restarts this whole backlash against, using our tried and true system of federal courts and resorting to military commissions or just simply indefinite detention without charge.
How about assassination?
Right, or the whole other problem of assassination and of targeted killings.
You know what it reminds of, the military commissions in particular? It's like when you debase a coinage, and you keep debasing it, and ultimately what happens is you start debasing it with military commissions in very narrow instances, supposedly, or Bush, and then you keep doing it, and it eventually just takes over the whole system, and it begins to debase even the regular system.
Yeah. That's absolutely right. I mean, we see that with even on the debate over Miranda, right? Which is and the whole idea of every time something happens, the fault is laid on the system. But I think we really need to start looking elsewhere. The problem isn't the criminal justice system. There are problems about terrorism. We need to focus on those problems and not simply respond in a knee-jerk fashion every time something happens and say we just need to get, tougher and take away more rights or strip U.S. citizens, as the recent bill by Lieberman proposes, who are supposedly engaged in supporting terrorism, strips U.S. citizens of their citizenship.
Yeah, it's not a particularly good time, and I did expect better in the new administration, although I probably was naive in doing that. But on these national security issues, it hasn't gone well. Now, Jonathan, is there any last thing? I mean, I'm hopeful the whole Cotter case will just fall on its own head, and that'll end the whole thing, but I'm not sure it's going to happen.
I'm not sure that's going to happen.
What do you think, Jonathan?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's possible that there may be some kind of plea deal worked out. I mean, there's been some news stories about that. I mean, there are some people in the Obama administration who really want this resolved, that don't want this case to go forward, and I think that's a possibility, if the terms are right. But you have a down the road, though, even if Cotter's case is taken care of without any further damage to our values and our legal framework, you still have the lurking issue of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the others accused of 9/11. There's obviously, those are people in a different category. There's not going to be, some kind of plea agreement where they go free. I mean, the U.S. is going to try to hold these people, understandably. And the real question is whether they're going to be prosecuted in federal court, as Eric Holder announced last November, as they should be, or whether the Obama administration is going to backtrack and backslide and try to put KSM and the other alleged 9/11 participants back in a military commission. And I think that is going to just would be a disastrous decision, and is going to if you think there are problems happening now and you're seeing the problems in the commissions with Qatar, they're going to be magnified tenfold when if they put KSM in the commission. So, I think, even if Qatar is resolved, and I hope it is, the commissions are still there, and, this is going to go on for a while.
To give an historical perspective, we had two cases before military commissions, I think, under Bush. We had the Hicks case and then the so-called Bin Laden driver. One was pleaded to 9 months, and the other guy essentially got time served plus 6 months or something. And that's in 8 years of so-called speedy justice while you're sitting with 900 people having gone through, or some of them remaining still at Guantanamo. And now you're under a year and a half almost of the Obama administration. And you have one lousy, and I don't say lousy from him, but one 15-year-old kid going through a military commission. Do they have any interest in really trying anybody at all? I mean, are they just really want to just this is not really important to them. They have to do something to make it look like it's moving, but they just keep these guys in jail forever. What are they? It's, I don't know. I mean, I just want your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're, I mean, I think it's, you know, I think they don't know. I think they haven't really, you know, they haven't made a, you know, they want to sound reformist and better, but they haven't made a break. And, you know, you have the problem of, I mean, commissions are just a piece of Guantanamo, you know, as we know. I mean, there's the huge problem of just people who are being detained without trial. So, you know, even if you kind of pulled the commissions out of the equation altogether, you still have the problem that the administration is holding individuals indefinitely, you know, now into the ninth year, and potentially permanently, right, without, you know, ever charging them with a crime. And some of these people really have no relationship to anything that we would recognize as a law of war or battlefield detention. You know, I represent someone named Mohamedou Slahi, who was arrested in Mauritania, in East Africa, of all places, rendered, tortured, and brought to Guantanamo. Never was on a battlefield, never even was accused of engaging in a terrorist act, just someone who they suspect is a bad guy or knows bad people. And he's being, you know, locked up potentially permanently on this whole idea of the global war on terror. And the Obama administration, you know, has not broken from that.
Yeah, I would say it's unfortunately a very consistent policy with the Bush administration on these issues. And what's worse is it's a Democratic administration. And in my view, that sort of stamps the policy more permanently on the country and our Constitution. But, well, Jonathan, thank you. And thank you for continuing your representation. And Jonathan Heifetz, we've been speaking with from the ACLU on military commissions and just a bit on his own client, one of whom is still in Guantanamo.
We'd like to have you back on at the end of the Cotter thing, Jonathan. Thank you very much for being on.
And Jonathan will be an old guy. His kids will be in high school.
At the end of the Cotter trial.
It's unbelievable. You can mark the, you know, like exactly. No kidding, Michael. When it opened, I think back anyway. All right.
When it opened, you had no children and you weren't married. I mean, what are you? I mean,
right? It's unbelievable. You're right. Your kids will be outgrown and out of college by the time. Unbelievable.
Okay, Jonathan.
You're on the subway for half price.
Okay, Jonathan.
Great to talk.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.